Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
A life that has the stories to back it. A life to be proud of. It's a Winchester life.
Yeah, baby. 6'8 Western. Oh, mule deer, baby, right there.
Tune in every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Mike Schultz, affectionately known as Schultzy, is the owner of Schultz Outfitters Fly Shop and Guide Service in southern Michigan. Growing up in Michigan, he developed a connection with the outdoors, which ultimately led him to pursue a career in the fly fishing industry. Spending countless hours on the water each year, Schultzy has honed his expertise in Midwestern waters and beyond. While his primary focus remains on the warm water fishing havens of southern Michigan, his angling adventures have taken him to exotic locations around the world. Driven by a passion for conservation, Schultzy has played a pivotal role in founding annual fundraisers like the Huron Riven Single Fly and Huckin' for the Huron in collaboration with the Huron River Watershed Council. Outside of his angling pursuits, Schultzy resides in Dexter, Michigan, nestled along the banks of the Huron River with his wife Allie and their sons Tanner and Dylan. In this episode of Anchored, we discuss the process of opening his fly shop in Ypsilanti, tactics for catching smallmouth bass on the fly, the effects of water temperature, tackle, and more. You've been on my list for forever.
Nice. Well, I mean, we go back a little ways. I mean, the shop's 12 years old. I think you were here the first year, maybe, or second year.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Been a minute. Yeah.
Cool. And I'm coming back in November. I'll have to come in and say hello.
Nice. Nice. That'll be cool. I'll be around in November. Yeah. Heck yeah.
Cool. Well, let's start where we start with everyone. So where were you born and raised?
Believe it or not, I was born about... miles from here. Yeah. At a hospital that no longer exists.
So okay. How weird is that? I'm going to butcher this, but is it Ypsilanti?
Ypsilanti, Michigan. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Ypsilanti. So yeah, my parents didn't live in Ypsilanti. They're a little ways away from here, but the hospital that my brother was born at and other cousins and whatnot that are younger than me didn't exist. So the hospital that I was born at was right down the road from here, 2 miles. Like I said, it's gone now, but I was born there in 1981.
1981. You're one of one of us 80 babies, barely an 80s baby, but you're one of us. Right. What about when we did that tying night? That was at your parents' place, right? Or is that?
Oh, no, that was at a friend's. That was at a friend's cottage.
Okay. Yeah. Pretty nice cottage.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Are your parents nearby then? Are they also in Michigan?
Yeah, my parents are only about 15 miles, maybe 20 miles from here. So they're pretty darn close. Yeah, I'm pretty boring on the whole, you know, where have I lived? You know, I've literally lived in the same watershed my whole life. So that's kind of wild.
Envious, honestly, I'm jealous.
Yeah, the Huron River watershed. Obviously traveled a lot, ran all over the place in sports and obviously fishing. But I'm just kind of, this is my spot. I'm locked in.
It's a good spot. And actually, I'm pretty public about this. I've done quite a bit of the Great Lakes scene, and Michigan is one of my favorite places. I could live in Michigan. And I really mean that. The steelhead fishing is great. Bass fishing is great. The hunting looks awesome. And it was actually you and Jerry and Liske who put it on my radar. So thank you for that.
No problem. Yeah. Michigan is a pretty rad place. You know, we, you definitely don't jump up and down about it and promote it too much. But I mean, it's a pretty, if you're into angling, it's a pretty special place. I mean, just the diversity of fish, the ability to get away, the access, you know, you got the lower peninsula, which we're in, and then you have the upper peninsula, which just is a different world. And I've been fortunate enough to have access to that with a family, you know, hunting camp that's been in the family since the 50s. So, it's pretty tough to leave. You know, if you really get it dialed in, you spend enough time and really know where to be at the right time, I could fish my whole rest of my life here and be pretty content.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like you might be doing just that. Talk to me a little bit about how you got into the outdoors. I actually didn't know that your family had a hunting background. So tell me the whole story.
Yeah. So I was fortunate enough to be born, to my mom and dad, Gary Schultz, Karen Schultz. My dad was an outdoorsman from a young age. Unfortunately, my dad's father passed away when he was 3 years old in a car accident. So my dad's mother, so my grandmother, her sister married a fellow named John. And John kind of took my father under his wing when it came to outdoors. So he introduced him to hunting, introduced him to fishing at an early age. And like I said, that family camp, here's a full circle story for you. That family camp was, I believe, purchased in 1953 up in the UP, a town called north of Rapid River, Michigan, up in the Upper Peninsula, just south of Marquette. Purchased by John and other friends in the industry. They're in the building trades. They bought that. And like I said, my dad's father passed away. John kind of took my dad under his wing, taught him about hunting, taught him about fishing. I believe, don't quote me on this, but sometime in the late 70s, my dad was asked to become a member of that camp. And then I was born in 1981. So it was always kind of one of those dangling carrots when I was a kid of, when I could go to deer camp, because it was back then they were in their prime. So these boys were drinking and partying and going to the bar and things you really can't do.
Manhood.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was a teenager, I was playing hockey, so I wasn't really able to jump right in there at age 14, but somewhere when I started driving, I was able to go up there. But I'll make this a little bit quicker. So started going up there, hunting, doing a little bit of fishing. And then when John passed away 5-6 years ago, guess who was next in line to be a member of the camp? So I actually took my father's mentor's spot in the family camp, and I was able to buy into it.
Wait,
and,
only 5 or 6 years ago?
That's when he passed away. Yeah.
So, whoa.
So, and I was next in line to grab the spot. So yeah, so kind of cool. It's little cabin up in the woods, up in northern Michigan, in Delta County. And like I said, it's been in the family since the 50s, and it's definitely changed, but pretty cool spot and a good place to get away. A good bug out spot if you needed it.
Yeah, no doubt. Don't tell anyone where it is. What about hunting or fishing then? Which one came first?
Both. I'd say fishing for sure. I remember, catching bluegills, catching bass. My dad had canoes and little boats and stuff when I was a little kid. I remember rolling around and catching bluegills and some of early photos of me, my father and my grandfather were baskets of bluegills and, a little largemouth and whatnot on family vacations. But that's kind of how it started. And then, what really changes you, if you're into angling, what really changes, your path is you get a truck, So you turn 16 around here, you get your license and then boom, I'm shooting off. And believe it or not, I literally vividly remember sitting on this island right outside of the shop right now when I was in high school, and I broke a fly rod casting. The ferrule came loose and, chucking some garbage fly line and fishing a woolly bugger or something. I broke it. And I remember sitting down there and, I always knew that I was going to work for myself. You ask my mom, it's like, and you, by the time you were 12, you were going to open a business and you were doing that, figuring out ways to make money any way you can. And anyway, so I'm sitting out there, couldn't have been 20 years old, 19, 18, somewhere around there. I'm looking up, that'd be a pretty rad spot for a fly shop, literally staring at this building from the island down there. And you know, what do you know? 12 years ago, I finally opened this store. And a funny story, my kid I played hockey with at Eastern Michigan University, his dad owned the building, you know, so.
What was it? What was the store?
This was actually this building. The whole building was a, I don't know if that's killing you, the phone ring.
No, no, it's all right. You're in the shop right now.
Yeah. This building was an interior design place. Like they would custom make curtains and, you know, all kinds of stuff out of here. And I definitely, before I had this building, definitely partied with my teammates here and slept in here one night when it was a drapery / furniture store.
It's perfect though. It's a perfect place for a fly shop.
Right, right. And it was, you know, perfect vicinity of the bars and whatnot. So yeah, I spent some time here because I went to school right up the hill. So yeah, Ypsilanti, home of Eastern Michigan University. You know, who put Eastern Michigan on the university on the map? I would say the Iceman, George Gervin. Most recently, Max Crosby of the Raiders football player. Anyways, Earl Baby Boykins, a little short guy on the NBA back in the day. But yeah, Eastern Michigan University, absolute powerhouse in the MAC conference, right up the hill here.
What river are you beside? Just to give some context.
The Huron River. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
So we guide a whole bunch of different rivers. You know, we kind of joke that the Huron is the sacrificial lamb, right? Did you get those fish out of the Huron? Well, there's some big ones in there, but it's pretty tough. But yeah, it's the fish that you see that we, you know, I guess we'd say post are, you know, not necessarily from the Huron, but it is right out here. River runs 112 miles, I believe, drains a huge watershed. You know, there's dams on it. So it's a river within a river, right? You don't ever know the river, you know, a section of the river, but up where you have been, up where I live, and where Jay Wisnowski, one of our guides, and Nick Meinsinger, another one of our guides, we all live up there in a town called Dexter. And that section of water, like you'd swear you were on a trout stream. It's crystal clear, beautiful, very well taken care of by the watershed council and the locals. There's no trash, Metro Parks running through the whole thing. And actually, believe it or not, since 1981, it's been 100% catch and release for bass.
What prompted that?
What prompted it was a joint study between the University of Michigan and Michigan State University to just study smallmouth, you know, in a river environment. So they did that. And a little funny story about that. So it was supposed to be temporary.
Right.
And it was one of those things that just never got changed. And I remember when I was young and
funny how really, that happens.
Right?
Policy.
Yeah. I was young and really, really hungry to make a change. And, you know, we set up a meeting with the watershed council on the DNR. And one a guy who was working for me at the time named Ryan put together, you know, this like dream of a proposal. Right. So we sit down, we got our meeting. It's going to happen. They're going to listen to us, you know, and Ryan started speaking and talking about what he'd like to see and da, 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 da. And we were met with, I think you guys should just be quiet because what you have could be taken away from you a lot quicker than what you guys want to add to it. And we were like, huh? You know, we better just be quiet. So yeah, it is a wonderful piece of water, but I always often tell clients, like, you know, we book dates, we don't book rivers. So we're really having as many guys as we have really on the pulse of what's going on, and things change drastically around here. But people will call and want to book a trip and say, I want to fish the Huron. It's like the Huron is like, if you just got your golf clubs and you're learning how to golf and they're like, hey, let's go golf. Okay. We're going to go golfing. Where are we going to go? We're going to go to Pebble Beach. That's going to be your first experience for golf. You're probably not going to do too well. So the Huron has its time and its place, but the truth is the Huron has big fish. They're big for a reason. And where we really enjoy fishing them, it's crystal clear. So it's a thinking man's game, a thinking, you know, woman's game, an angler's game where you really need to be sharp and you can't go there and just hoof and poof and, you know, laceration nation, as my boy Russ Madden would say, the water, and expect good results. You really need to be an A+ angler before you really venture into that realm.
So you are obviously a sports guy. You lose me on every reference ever with sports, but not the hockey ones. So we do have hockey in common. Tell me about your career in hockey or what your path was in the hockey world.
Yeah. I mean, I just played growing up from a young age, and I was fortunate to, my kids are in youth sports right now, so I might give you too much details, but I think that what has changed is people jump around too much. So like I was fortunate enough to get hooked up with good families, good players, and a group of players that families decided we're going to keep these kids together. You know, it's not going to be like, you know, one year and I'm going to dip off and go to play for another team or whatever. So the core group of guys that I grew up playing with, it was special. And it really, I think, you know, sports and the journey that I took with you know, that group and winning really sets you up for things later in life, right? So like anyways, I played, I'm an 81 birth date. I played up a year until I was in Pee Wees, you know, played for, I guess if people are out there that know hockey, I played for Little Caesars, I played for CompuWare. Those are a couple of the AAA teams in this area. It was a different game back then, you know, obviously a totally different game with you know, the speed of the game and the skill of the players and all the things that go into it. But the AAA level back then was small. You only had four or five teams, you know, in Michigan. Nowadays there's a whole bunch, you know, so hockey's grown so much, but anyways, played at a high level. Got to do all the fancy things that you do as a peewee, got to go to the Quebec tournament and, you know, all that cool stuff. Literally parents bald tires going to Toronto area. You know, I spent a lot of time in Canada growing up, played midgets, you know, did that whole route, and then just ended up here at the University of Eastern Michigan University, just playing club hockey, you know, nothing fancy. I was not a D1 athlete by any means. You know me, I'm not the biggest dude. Game has changed a lot, but like those lessons that you learn playing that game and teamwork and what it takes and the effort you got to put for when you're not being watched, you know, practice and all that kind of stuff. I mean, sets you up for a pretty good life. So what my parents were able to sacrifice and whatnot, I'm trying to replicate that for my children. They both play hockey, and I'm actually going to miss the Midwest Fly Fishing Expo for the first time since I was a teenager, because Tanner's team is in the state championship the same weekend. So
that's a fair excuse.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can't miss that for your bowl. You only get four shots at winning the state championship in Michigan. You get it in Swords, Peewees, Bantams, and Midgets. So, I'm stoked for him and the journey that his team is on. And yeah, hockey's a great sport. If you're a young parent out there and you're looking for a sport that will, you know, just lifetime bonds and lessons learned, I honestly can't think of a better game than the game of hockey. It's just a beautiful sport.
So how did you manage prioritizing hockey and fishing in your teens specifically?
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't have much time. You know, I really didn't. When you're playing at a high level, you know, playing at the AAA level, you don't have much time. And, you know, I spent a lot of time away from school. You know, I definitely maxed out the amount of time that I could miss per semester with travel and whatnot. But the fishing boat, like I said, it really didn't take off till I got wheels. You know, 16 is when you could kind of, you know, scoot away. And again, you know, the game was different back then. You shelved it for a couple months in the summer. You know, you might have did a hockey camp for a weekend or two, but like you shelved it. Nowadays, these kids go year round. So yeah. My window for angling was in the summertime, you know, gotcha. And I wasn't. Yeah. And I didn't get real serious about it until I really found fly fishing, you know, and watching like OLN. You remember OLN?
Yeah.
Before it was like, this isn't awesome. You watch like Andy Mill and them fishing and doing all that kind of stuff and saw that. And, you know, you watch Dukes of Hazzard and then you'd watch, you know, the next thing would come on would be fishing, you know, before you went to hockey practice. And I got into fly fishing and saw that. And I'm like, this looks really easy. Like you just buy a line and, you know, like just a couple flies, you go out and get it done, you know. And then I found a fly shop.
Which one? Which fly shop?
Uters Outdoors in Northville, Michigan.
Okay.
And I pretty much did what a lot of people do in this industry, just to get your foot in the door. You literally just hang out at the fly shop so much that they're like, hey kid, take the garbage out. Hey kid, you know, go clean the bathroom. Hey kid, whatever, fix the fly bins, you know, fix all the messes. And hung out there. And then just like, dude, I want to work here. Like, you clearly like, yo, you know, I want to work here, John, you know? So finally got a job there. And, you know, just doing the basic stuff, learning, you know, doing handwritten orders and just everything the old school way.
And how old are you?
Teenager, like right around when I was starting to hang out with Allie, my wife.
Oh, right. Because you guys have been together for forever, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I think I met her I knew her in high school, but we started dating when she was 19.
Oh, she's such a babe. Honestly.
Yeah, she is. She's awesome.
You've lucked out big special. Time.
I lucked out big time. Yeah, I definitely rated there. So just hung out and got the job at the fly shop. And just weird, just kind of a wild path. And I've told this story before, but I worked at that fly shop. It eventually kind of went out of business. And then about a year went by and they restructured and opened with new partners. And I was the first hire there and worked there for a while. And then the owner had a little falling out with the big money guy, you know, and they got to the point where they were going to separate. And I was kind of had a little dilemma where I was kind of like, what do I do here? Do I stay here and kind of continue down this path? Or do I go with the guy that I have feelings for? That's the guy that gave me my start, that's getting booted, and go with him. And I'm a young kid. So I, you know, who do you go to? You go to your parents. Like, what do you think I should do here? You know? And, you know, they helped me weigh my options and whatnot. And we decided that I need to talk with the guy that was separating. So I end up talking with John, and John said, you know, just to put it in the simplest form, he just said, hey kid, this is your opportunity. You're not hurting my feelings. You know, the decisions that I made and the path that deck of cards I'm being dealt has nothing to do with you. And I think that you should take this shot. So, you know, when I think my junior year of college, I I made that decision, and I hung in there. I finished up my last semester. What happened was I graduated kind of halfway through the year. I had an injury where I broke my scaphoid bone in my hand, which was the worst thing to come back from, because I'm a right-hander, so it's my lower hand on my stick, and very painful. But my brother was coming in as a freshman, and I was going out as a senior. So I ended up playing like a half a semester at the end of the year, at the end of the year where I didn't have any school. So I managed the fly shop and went to practice and did what I needed to do and got to play a year with my brother, his freshman year, my senior year. And the rest is history. Worked for that shop for a while. Let's say another 2 years go by, and got headhunted out of there from another shop. Things were kind of going south with the guy that, you know, got rid of my buddy. Ended up not being the greatest human, and kind of a hard guy to work for. I'm all for doing things the hard way, but it was a little too much. I got headhunted out of there, went and ran a shop out in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I think I was there for maybe four and a half years, and decided I was going to do my own thing. And went out, guided full time for a couple seasons, and then got my act together and got this place opened in March 2nd of 2012.
Wow. So, jeez.
Wild little ride.
Yeah.
So many things that happened that like worked out perfect for what we've built here, you know? And I say we, because I can't do this all myself, but when I was a kid, bass fishing in Michigan, you could only do it legally from the last Saturday in May until December 31st.
Okay.
So they changed the rules and made it year round. If that didn't happen, I'd be jumping that down. Let's go steelhead fishing. Let's go trout fishing. But I mean, we literally smallmouth fish now 12 months a year, which if you were to have told me that 10 years ago, I'd have been like, you're crazy. How are you going to catch fish when 33 degree water temp? You can do it.
How? I mean, we're going to come back to that. First, I've got a couple questions. I've got more questions for you about the shop, because your shop is actually really quite incredible. I've been to a lot of fly shops in my years, and your shop is one of my favorites. It's got a very different vibe when you walk in. Obviously, it's a beautiful building. It's in a great location. It's in a superb location, in my opinion. But you walk in and there's this energy. It doesn't matter if you are a man, woman, child, whatever age you are. You walk in and you guys are there to help. You all are so down to earth. You got some seriously well-known talent in your shop. You've always got stock. You've got a crazy business head on you. I mean, everything that you've got going on in that shop is what a fly shop, in my opinion, should be. So kudos 100%. To you for that. And I just want to plug out that anyone going through should definitely stop by. Also, you guys do online orders as well, right? Good business online.
April, we are old school.
Really?
No.
So
no,
we
do all this craziness by talking to people and emails.
Well, and phone orders, right?
And building relationships. Yes, it's all, I'm old school. The headaches that you have in a little store like this, I mean, it's not little, right? Like it's the building is 4,500 square feet. It's 4,000 square feet of selling space. You haven't even seen what it looks like now. It's been a long time since you've been here. But yeah, I mean, it's like, we are so like, people call me crazy all the time. And I'm not saying I'm never going to do the online thing, but like, I thoroughly enjoy the business model and the way that we're doing things. And it makes a difference. You know, it really does. Like I want all the customers. Yes, you want all the customers, but I have my ideal customer. Just like if you're a guide, you have your ideal angler. Like we have a special group of customers, a totally different culture. As you know, the vibe here is different. You know, even when you just call and talk to people, it's different. But yeah, just old school. Yeah, the IG store, Facebook store will sell hats, t-shirts, feathers and stuff on there, but you can't go on SchultzOutfitters.com and buy, you know, 40 different Loomis rods. Like
I did not know that.
Oh, we're old school. I always joke. It's like, you got to actually, people will be like, where's your online store? It's like, no, you call the number, you talk to a human. And not only is it a human, but that human knows how to fish and they know how to tie and they can answer any question. They'll be your best friend. They'll give you their cell phone number. You can text them. You know, it's just a whole different business model.
See, I knew when my members were calling in orders that you guys were doing it old school on the phone, but I thought they had the option of doing it online. And I have noticed when I was in the shop, the handful of times I've been there, the phone is nonstop. I mean, it's after hours right now, which is why it's quiet in there. But phone is nonstop. So is that one of the reasons why you guys must do a lot of phone orders?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We say we're your local fly shop. Doesn't matter if you're in Pittsburgh or Florida or California or whatever. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's correct, but I mean, I don't know how many times I hear on the phone is like, my local shop sucks, man. You guys are awesome. Like you have everything, you're on it. You know what's up. You know, it's like, I don't know. Call me crazy. I'm not content, but I'm happy where we're at and I'm happy how we do things. And I think that people really appreciate it.
I know that people appreciate it. Talk to me a little bit about your fly fishing journey. So I know you mentioned watching OLN, but how did it all start?
Yeah. So I guess you could say like, I really was introduced to fly angling by going steelhead fishing.
How that works. Yeah.
Of course, it always goes back to hockey, but I had a buddy that I used to hang out with a lot when I was playing, and his dad was an avid steelhead river fisherman, steelhead and salmon fisherman in Michigan. So took us up steelhead fishing when we had spring break or something. We had no hockey. We went to the Betsy River up in Benzonia County, a small little river. He gets a steelhead run, gets a salmon run, cohos, kings, all that stuff. Took us up there and I'd never seen that scene before, you know, like old school walk and wade, just get in there, go through the woods, you know, learn the basics and, you know, watch people hook these 20, 30 pound salmon in these tiny rivers. You know, they're cartwheeling, they're going nuts and, you know, they're breaking them off and losing them. And every once in a while, someone will land one. But that kind of was the start of it. And that same guy's like, I'll bring you guys back steelhead fishing in the spring. So, you know, actually I said spring break, but it was fall when he took us for salmon. And then he took us steelhead fishing in the spring. And we went back to the same river. And then he introduced us to other rivers, the Muskegon, as you've been on, the Pier Marquette. And just that was the kind of the start of it. And I enjoyed it so much. I'm like, what am I going to do all summer? You know, these migratory fish aren't in the rivers. So what do I do? And I don't want to drive 5 hours or 4 hours to get there. So I found this stretch of river. Like I said, my parents live 15 minutes from here. So I found the Huron River. And what did I find in the Huron River? I found smallmouth bass. So, you know, that was kind of the start. I hooked my first smallmouth bass on the river and I'm like, this is rad. You know, and I'm old enough to know that, like, I mean, it come from the era where it was like, you know, you went to the fly shop I worked at, it was like a trout line, a saltwater line, you know, a crude sink tip, you know, and that was it. You know, the biggest, I mean, this would have been around the time like Kelly's first book came out, you know, like a zoo cougar is 3 inches long. Oh my, what? Thing's huge. How are you going to throw that? You know? So I came from the old school, you know, like Matuka and a Mickey Finn and a black nose dace and a, you know, whatever, you know, like that's what you threw, or a wooly bugger and caught bass. But yeah, I mean, I found the Huron, I found moving water and I was like, this is my jam. Like lake fishing's cool, but I'm in an ever changing environment. I was here 2 days ago, it was 6 inches higher. Now it's, you know, low and I'm waiting. And I'm like, I like this. I like to have to be on it, you know, versus just showing up at a lake. So yeah, the river fishing got, you know, sunk its teeth into me and I've been a river rat ever since.
Okay. Got it. So, and then the fly fishing, was it as hard as you expected it to be? Or I mean, was it as easy as you expected it to be from watching, or did you get hit with reality check?
Oh, definitely reality check. I mean, I, you know, went out there with a, you know, Cortland, you know, double taper, you know, 5'5" 6" weight rod type deal, Fenwick, and got after it. And, you know, it was definitely, you know, I did all the things that everybody does, you know, like you had to learn how to tie a nail knot because there's no loops. And, right. You know, you bought a million little leaders that you'd eventually chop down. And like, how do I tie the line on the end? Like, you know, put a swivel on it, I guess, you know, like all these crude setups, because we didn't have the internet back then, really.
Yeah.
You know, you had to buy the books and the books were like old school. Any book you got 10 years old, you're looking at it like, what? I got to put mucilin on my line? What?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, old like, school. What the heck is this crap? But yeah, I mean, and then like, yeah, I started hanging out at the fly shop and like teeny lines came out, sink tips. And,
game changers, yes.
You know, slime lines. Intermediates, that's what you used to call them, slime lines.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm showing my age here, right? But
no,
yeah,
you're you're taking me through a walk down memory lane. I actually forgot that we used to call them slime lines.
Yeah.
We use them for coho, but yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, think about like right when Feenstra got going, I was like in college and like swinging flies with a thing, like just getting going. I remember calling Simon and be like, Simon, like I bought this wind cutter
right.
And I can't throw 10 feet of T14 on it. He's like, oh yeah, mate, you know, you gotta cut it down. You know, like what? I think $80. I gotta cut it down. He's like, yeah. Grab a tape measure, cut 15 feet off and just cut it. Yeah, just cut it. You know, like the crap we had to do back then, it's just gotten so much easier. But yeah, it sucked back then. It was difficult. You had to be on your game and you had to, I guess, think outside the box and like modify your own stuff. You know, we're getting old.
I know. Yeah. Is there anything, looking back now or looking at your own fly shop, is there anything that you think needs modification now that the industry, I'm jumping ahead because I want to come back to your fishery, but in the shop, is there anything that you would change? Is there anything that you think the industry is lacking or lagging behind with right now?
Natural feathers.
Natural feathers?
Yeah. 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 Hard to get natural feathers these days. Not really. I'd say like one of the most confusing things that like, you know, you really need to be dialed in with these days is fly line. Right. And, you know, like there's so many options. I think it's a little bit overwhelming for a lot of newbies and whatnot. I think that, you know, the rods have gotten so much faster. You know, they really haven't changed like the standards of grain weights, you know, since I don't know when, the 70s, the 60s, I don't know.
Actually, yeah, that's a good one. That one could probably use some fixing. Yep.
Right.
Or some improvements or revisions, some updates.
Yeah. Some updates. I mean, you got like some, like, you know, I'm an airflow guy. You know, you got some airflow lines these days that you know, a 6 weight, you put on a 7 weight. And then you got some lines that, you know, 8 weight, you got to put on a 7 weight. So there's a little, you know, weirdness in there. That's Rio, that's SA, that's Airflow, it's all of them. But that's where a pro shop comes in. That's where, you know, a shop like ours comes in, where it's like you get that customer that calls us because they saw a reel or a story or a post and they're like, I bought that line, but I don't see, it's not working for me. And it's like, okay, well, what rod do you have? I got this rod. Well, what fly line weight did you put on? Well, there's your deal. You put the wrong line on it. You know, so I think fly lines are a little confusing. And maybe like, you know, rods, I mean, they do already do it with spay. They put the grain weights, the kind of the sweet spot on there. You know, I think that'd be something that would be important. And what we do here is we build spreadsheets. We get on the spreadsheets, we build out, we lay all the fly line companies out there, the lines that we like, and put little notes next to them and like, just let you know kind of, but that's what you're going to get when you come to a shop like this, is we can share that knowledge with you because we're actually out doing it and actually fishing. You believe that? You work at a fishing store, you might want to fish.
You'd be amazed how many people work in shops who don't actually fish. So that touche. Talk to me a little bit about fly lines, if you don't mind. Do you think it's necessary, all the fly lines nowadays, or do you think that it's mostly marketing? Just, I don't want to get you in trouble with anyone, but what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, no, I think it's necessary. I mean, yeah, every fishery is different. I mean, I use a bunch of different lines for different applications and different watersheds. You know, like just a kind of the first thing that pops into my head is you've been on the waters that we fish. Most of them are pretty darn small, you know, and, you know, if you're an angler that smallmouth bass fishes and you're on rivers like ours, you're going to have a set of fly lines. And then if you're on a river the size of the Mississippi or the Muskegon or some of the bigger rivers, you're going to use a different fly line. And, you know, the reason for that is like at our smaller rivers, when you're smallmouth fishing, the angle is very important and you're not really tracking the fly at distance. So a lot of the fly lines that we use are 32 to 38 feet head lengths. Whereas if you're on and if you're using any type of sinking line, it's usually an intermediate and very rarely we touch a sink tip. But you're on a big river where you're tracking the fly at distance, you're going to need a totally different fly line to do that, you know, to keep your fly in the zone and track at distance. Where here, we're kind of making these chip shots and working it across, and you're presenting the fly, you know, in different ways depending on the water temps. But other rivers, you're taking it away from them at distance and you need that fly line to hold. You know, and I often use this as like, we're big on intermediate lines because of the size of our watershed. And we're going to change the weight of the fly versus changing the size of the fly. You're going to change the physical weight for depth, speed, and whatnot. Whereas if you're on like a big and you're fishing with an intermediate, you're fishing the fly. You feel the fly is moving and you're fishing the fly. Whereas if you're fishing a sink tip, you're fishing the line and the fly is kind of going along for a ride and you really can't feel that fly. You're feeling the weight of the line. So our fisheries are just different, and you could have a smallmouth guide from Minnesota or a smallmouth guide from Pennsylvania, and we could have similar watersheds, or you could have those same three different states and be like, yo, dude, I'm fishing a river that's 300 yards wide. You're fishing one that's 30 yards wide. Totally different game, you know? So yeah, fly lines are important, and dialing in your fly lines, not only the proper weight, the proper head length, the proper sink rate, but also dialing in those leaders. You know, the proper leader length, the proper build, the turnover, so much stuff goes into it. And how do you learn all that stuff? You experiment with it. You know, just because I say it doesn't mean it's going to work on your river or the way you like to fish. So, it's fly fishing. There are no rules, April.
I know it. What about your spreadsheet? How does someone get access to that? So they come in and you sit, say, have a seat, open a beer, and you suddenly lay out this beautiful spread?
No, I mean, we got them sitting up by the, you know, as you... You know, there's pre-trip information. You know, we're all advanced. We got the QR code. You know, we're fancy.
Yeah, look at you. No online store, but you've got QR codes.
Yeah, but if you're old school and you want to grab a paper copy, you can grab a paper copy. It just lays it all out on there. But I mean, we are educators. You know, you want to, how much time you got, buddy? You know, you want to sit down and go through this stuff. But I mean, just yesterday we had a guy come in with like a Yeti tote, just loaded with fly lines and reels, and he's just like, help. And we're like, okay, you know, let's do it. Let's lay them all out. You know, let's see what's up. What you got, buddy? But yeah, no, it's it's important to be a shop that educates and knows their stuff. And, you know, fly lines, I guess, would be the answer of things that, you know, one, we can improve the way they are. I don't know the answer to it. And two, like, I think that that's the most important piece of your gear. I mean, it really is. I can take a cheap fly rod and put a really good fly line on it and make it work.
Yep.
You know, it doesn't matter if you got a $2,000 reel hanging off that thing.
Forget
if your fly
reel,
line, yeah. Yeah, if your fly line's not on point for what you're doing,
you know,
you've been in my boat. You're one angler. There's six rods.
Yeah, you take it very seriously. Let's talk a little bit about the fishery and get into some fishing chat, if you don't mind. So,
oh, yeah, I love fishing.
I know. Upper and Lower Peninsula. Talk to me about the difference there, just for people who have never been to Michigan and they're trying to get a feel geographically with what we're working with here.
Yeah. Let's do the hand, right? So we've got the hand here. That's the Lower Peninsula. Right. And then you got the Upper Peninsula. It's over top of it. There's a bridge that connects them called the Mackinac Bridge. I would say, I think I read it online, that like 85% of the people that live in Michigan have never been to the UP.
Why though?
I don't know.
Is it more wild? Is the UP considered more?
Oh yeah. There's not much going on up there. Yeah. There's Marquette, which is the big town. There's a college there, called Northern Michigan. And then a little bit further up, there's a peninsula called the Keweenaw Peninsula that sticks up off the Upper Peninsula. And there's a school up there called Michigan Tech. But outside of that, it's not, a lot of national forest. Tons of like amazing water, like on Lake Michigan, if you're into like fishing shallow and water that looks like the Bahamas, like big smallmouth carp.
Yeah. Pike. They've got big carp over there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I got a funny story. So I'm up there. I go up every year for 2 weeks with the family and we stay. Tanner and Dylan love to fish. So we go out and we fish and, always, you know, you're a parent, you're like, okay, you know, if you're good for the duration of the trip, we can go somewhere and get the knife shop. There's a knife shop, custom knife shop. We'll go to the custom knife shop and get you a knife, you know? So the kids behave really well and we go there and they're looking at the knives and the lady that's there working, she's like, so did you catch any fish, kids? You know, and they're like, yeah, we crushed the smallies. Caught a bunch of smallies. And the lady's like, oh, that's okay. And my kids are like, what? She's like, you didn't catch any, your dad doesn't know how to catch walleye? Like, no, we're here for smallmouth bass. So up there, the culture is eat
or go home. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's catch walleye and eat. So yeah, it's a different vibe up there. You know, people living off the land and youpers is what they refer to them as, those folk. And yeah, they're good people and, you know, just a different way of life up there, you know, and
yeah.
It's pretty cool. I mean, there's everything up there. There's moose up there. There's wolves up there. There's, mountain lions up there. You know, it's a different world. Pretty cool.
Do both peninsulas get steelhead?
Yeah. Oh yeah. They get wild run steelhead up there. Yeah. So Lake Superior is on the north side of it. North, the top of the Upper Peninsula butts up to Lake Superior. So you've got all those tributaries. They get coaster brook trout. They get, steelhead. They obviously get salmon. All that kind of stuff. It's amazing up there. There's so much cool stuff. You couldn't explore it in your lifetime.
Yeah, it's true. Why smallmouth? Why is smallmouth with you? Because even your logo, I do not know my bass species enough, but is it a smallmouth?
Yeah, it's a smallmouth. Yeah. Yep.
Yep. I mean, so first of all, gutsy call having a shop with a bass logo and bass focus and guiding mm-hmm. focus. But why smallmouth? Tell those of us who don't know enough about bass.
Yeah.
Why smallmouth?
So one, they're right here, readily available, right? There's a lot of fishing guides in Michigan, but back when I kind of started this whole circus, there was nobody that was doing smallmouth bass on a fly rod. You know, I mean, there was, but they were like, you know, firemen and school teachers that like did it on the weekends, you know, type deal. More entertainers than anything. They're just a really awesome fish. They're native. They're 100% wild. They get zero help from the DNR or, you know, the state to, you know, they just do their thing, you know, just amazing fish. When it comes to the river fishing, you know, there's barriers to entry, right? So it's not like a fish that was getting fish to, at a high level though, that was like a blank slate. I had all these rivers around here. Nobody's floating them. I remember the first time I took drift boat down the river and people were like, pretty big for that, pretty big boat for this river. You're like, it's just a little drift boat, you know, like, okay. You know, like people like looked at it like it was a spaceship coming down the river back in the late 90s, early 2000s. But yeah, I mean, they're just a rad fish. The things that we've learned about them over since the year round season, it just blows your mind. Like I've caught smallmouth 12 months a year in Michigan. I've caught them when the thermometer in the boat reached 33 degrees.
Give me some of these facts. I just thought that, you know, the first time I ever caught a smallmouth, I was in Ontario with Nick Pujic, and I had been warned that they pulled hard. Where were we? We were there fishing the Bay of Quinte, but he had another, it's been too long, I can't remember the main river we were on, but I couldn't believe what I was experiencing with smallmouth, and they gained my respect in my early 20s. But I don't know much about them biologically. So if you have any of those facts that are just standard knowledge for you guys, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have many facts besides they're just a really wicked fish. I mean, they're native, they're wild. It's a unique strain of fish that's, you know, native. If you look at their native range, it's fairly small, you know, but they've spread them out and moved them all over the country. And, you know, about as far south as I understand, you know, you catch them in northern Georgia, they catch them in Alabama. But, you know, native to the Midwest, native to Pennsylvania, up into southern Ontario. You know, they're built for rivers. I mean, they really are. I mean, they're a fish, opportunistic feeder, slow growth rates. You know, like if we catch a fish that's 20 inches long in the river, you know, people will call BS on it all the time, but those fish, the DNR says they're 15 plus years old, right? A 20 inch fish in Lake St. Clair that just can, you know, look everywhere around and eat gobies till they explode, that fish may only be 8 years old or 9 years old when they reach that 20 inch growth, but they max out. Like, I mean, you know how much time we spend on them. I mean, there's, we've caught out of all the, I started the guide service in 2003. And since then on our watersheds, I mean, we've went other places and caught big ones, but we've only caught one fish that measured 22 inches since 2003 in our rivers. We've caught a bunch of 21s, and we catch a handful, you know, 25 to 30, 20 inch fish a year, guiding clients. But yeah, I mean, it's a special fish when it reaches that size. And then once it gets there, it doesn't grow. It eventually just runs out of heartbeats and croaks, you know, or, you know, something happens to it. But yeah, I mean, it's a special fish. It's a native fish. It's a wild fish. They eat hexes. They eat mayflies. They eat terrestrials. They eat mice. They eat frogs. They eat all the bait fish, crayfish, helger mites. I mean, just a very opportunistic feeder that, you know, like I said before, you don't know a river, you know, a section, you know, of that river. And every section is different. The way that they feed, the way they behave, you're a product of your environment, you know, just a great, you know, it's just like anything you get really good at and you get, you know, you go all in on, like you just know the fish, like you figure out their personalities and how they are. They're different everywhere. Every section is different, you know, and once you get to that level and you spent that much time with them, you know where you need to be at that given time. And yeah, it's pretty rad. You know, I got that sixth sense when you spend enough time with a wild animal, you know how they behave, and you kind of have that gut, like, I need to be here today. Usually it works out if you know what we know.
But why do they pull so hard?
Their tails, I mean, they kind of got a squared off tail. I mean, they're just mean fish, you know? I don't know why. They're me in fish form, you know? Like, I am a smallmouth bass. If I was a fish, I'd be a smallmouth bass. You know, maybe that's why I'm attracted to them. But yeah, they're just strong. They're all muscle. They're, you know, they're thick, you know, they're just, yeah, they're sweet.
Yeah, they're like the Wolverine of the river. They really are.
They are. Yeah. Yeah. And then other days they're pricks and you can't, you know, they're just, they don't, the big fish are old, they're smart. And, you know, they'll come up and just bite the feathers on your tail sometimes. They'll come up, like we fish for them on certain beats of river with six weights and we'll go down to like 4X in the summertime. And these things will, you'll spot them, you'll make a perfect cast. They'll come up, tip underneath that foam bug. They'll fall back. You'll see their fins. They just look at it. They'll put their nose right on it. And they'll go, eh, I'm good. And just swim away. Other rivers will smack. The same time of year you throw a frog out there and it's just gone, you know, but you're only 30 miles away in a different direction and completely different fish, just a product of their environment.
Do you think it's just pressure, water temperature? Have you managed to have any sort of, you know,
forage, what they're eating.
Okay.
Yeah. What they're eating. Yeah. I mean, they could be, you know, a river that's, doesn't have a big bait fish population. Those fish are going to change their diets and they're going to have their, you know, their deal. Where springtime, they'll eat a 7-inch fly. In summertime, you throw a fly at them that's 2 inches, 3 inches long and they run away. But then you delicately drop a terrestrial on them. And I'm not talking about something you buy out of the bin. I'm talking about something that we craft and you're like going the next level to make that thing look like it's, you know, real. And then you go to another river and throw a piece of gum out there and they'll eat it. You know, it's just a totally different animal. But yeah, I mean, it's a wild fish, keeps you on your toes. You know, it's just a cool species. If you live by them and you're not taking advantage of them and you're a fly fisherman, you're nuts. You know, I mean, like our rebook rate here is like 99%. The only time we don't get people to come back is if you get some oddball thing where someone's from Ireland and they're here to go to U of M to do a talk and they're here for one day. Yeah. You know, you may never see that person again, but once you get in our boat, that's why we've been able to rapidly grow the guide service, because one day turns into three days turns into six. And once you're doing that many days with us, you're telling all your buddies and, you know,
booked out. So,
yeah. The boys stay busy and it's a very visually appealing fish because you can see it all go down. You know, you see it happen. It's not like you're out in the abyss of a lake. You're just stripping. Oh, there's a big one. It fights hard. That's awesome. You're seeing that fish come up and T-bone it. You're seeing it come up and sip that terrestrial, come up and sip a hex, come up and smash a frog. You know, it's all like, you know, you got to almost, when it's really going, you got to almost do like visual exercises just to calm yourself down if you're not used to doing it, because you're just ripping hooks, you know, out of them and missing them. So,
what about their spawning behavior and ethics around that, considering they're now open 12 months a year?
Yeah. So, fly fishing, I think fly fishermen just take a different approach, right? So, you know, we have all these rivers at our, you know, our disposal where I'm kind of centrally located where I live, where I can go 1 hour this way, 10 minutes to the river that way, 30, 45, whatever, I can jump around. But if you were to go out on a day like today, and we're in this weird weather pattern, I'm sure you guys are, or, you know, anybody in the Northern Hemisphere, I've got, yesterday was, I left here to go to Tanner's hockey game, was 80 degrees. It's February 28th. This morning, I get here, it's snowing. So just wild, right? But yeah, they you know, one river could be 5 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees warmer than another river that's on the same exact parallel. You know, and that's like one of those things is like, you don't know unless you know, right? You've been there before, you put in the time, you take the thermometer, you know exactly every time you go out. I have a jet boat now. As I got older, I needed to have that because I don't have as much time. So the jet boat allows me to run around, get indications on, you know, what the water temps are, conditions are. One thing that we struggle with every spring, it's a problem. It's a work. It sucks. You have to go to all the rivers and you got to run the floats without clients and make sure they're clear. You got a whole tree going across that. I mean, we do some major cutting, you know, where we go out with 3 or 4 chainsaws and clear our way through these rivers. So the jet boat allows me to run around, but the jet boat also gives me that, you know, my fish pond thermometer or my Orvis thermometer off the wall isn't as accurate as my hummingbird, you know, where I'm running, I can tell. So as soon as I get on the water in the jet boat, take a picture of the screen. And then middle of the day, I'll take a picture of the screen. And then the end of the day, I'll take a picture of the screen. So I'll have my temperatures throughout the day. And then I have that endless chart in my phone to know, you know, my cloud to know what it was, those conditions of those days. But very temperature oriented, not necessarily the spawn, but like right now, right? So if you're going out today, after that 80 degree day yesterday, water temps probably were 40 degrees. And we're talking, you know, Fahrenheit here. So 40 degrees in the morning, and you may get like a midday bump, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. It might be 44 on a sunny day. Right. On a cloudy day, it might only go 41, 42. But it's all about, in this really cold weather, it's all about that temperature bump. So you could go out there. There's no reason to be out there at 8 a.m. You know, this time of year, I'm like, oh, I'll get out there on 11, putz around, see some things. And I know I'm going to get my first bite around 12:45, 1 o'clock, and it'll go to 4, and then you'll see it slow down and taper off. And that's kind of the smallmouth. It's a warm water fish, right? It's not a trout, warm water fish. So they're really very, very sensitive to water temps. And if I'm going out this time of year, I want like bluebird skies, sun just blaring. Whereas if I'm fishing in May, I want it to be overcast, you know, maybe a little rain if I'm going to get a big one, you know. But this time of year, you want that sun to pump the water temps up and those fish to go. And this goes back to a guy who passed away a long time ago, but one of the first guys I worked with at that first fishing store, Buter's, his name was Joe Sattler. And I remember, like, I was really into smallmouth and I was learning about him at an early age. And I was like, you know, Joe was like the OG, like 70 years old at the time. I'm like, Joe, like smallmouth, like, you think you could catch him in the cold? You know, like, you, like, nobody, like, this is before the internet. So everything I said, like, everything started kind of at 45 50, or 50 degrees, really, all the books and stuff. And he's like, fish eat every day, kid. You'll figure it out. You know, and that was kind of a challenge. But yeah, I mean, that they are very temperature oriented, especially early season and late season when it's cold. You see those bumps. And then kind of how the season plays out for us is, you know, Husey, James Hughes, he's already started guiding. Like, so he was guiding trips in February for him. But once we really get rolling in about 2 weeks from now, middle of March, usually in a normal year, you're kind of in that high 30s to 40s and going into April. April start ticking into you're starting your days around 42 degrees. And then you'll get into like 45. And when you get into 45 degrees, that's when the fish really are willing to chase. So they're willing to move. And you'll see these fish move out of these dead, like what most anglers around here would look at as pike water, like just stagnant backwaters. That's where they're at now. And then eventually they'll start moving closer and closer to that seam. And then eventually when that water hits 50 degrees, they are, you throw that across a seam, bind a log jam, strip, have that thing come across, wham, you know, and like, you know, if it happens to me first, or if it happens to Hughes first, we're going to text our dude. They're on the bubble today. They're on the bubble. And once they get on that bubble, that's usually around high 40s, 50 degrees, and then sustained 55. Is going to be your spawning behavior. So when you start your day when it's 55 degrees, you know, I definitely have seen fish trying to make beds and stuff when it's like 50, but 55 is like your sustained 55 is going to be your trigger for the spawn.
Wait, so they spawn year round depending on temperature? It's not just one
spring. It's spring. Yeah, it's spring. Yeah, but you'll have like some river, like there's, like I said, there's rivers that are warmer around here that are in the same vicinity. You know, I might see a fish the first week of April, a little male, you know, not dusting off a bed. And then, you know, you can have other rivers that are a little bit further to the north that we guide that might be, you still see a fish on a bed in June, you know? So you got a really big window, you know? And like, I always tell people, like, not every fish is spawning at the same time.
Right.
So like to say like, I'm not going to fish today because there's a fish on a bed. Like, you know, as long as you're not targeting the fish on the bed. And to get back to your, you know, original question, it's like, I can't fish for that fish. Like, no way in heck am I going to do that. But your tournament anglers out there in bass boats are flipping, ripping them off the beds. And, you know, we don't have that type of population in these rivers where that's, you know, would even cross my mind that I'm going to disrupt them while they're doing that, you know? So definitely in my opinion, like, and our guides, like none of our guides are going to be caught dead and they'll be done. They're fired fishing fish off beds. It's just not happening. Like you can't do it. I think it's wrong. Especially on rivers, you know, and obviously we make our living off these fish and I think it's very disrespectful. That's just my two cents.
Yeah. I like it. Why are they allowed to do it in tournaments? Is it frowned upon in tournaments? I don't know anything about it.
No, that's how you make money in tournaments. Yeah. I mean, if they're on the beds, you turn on bass fishing on whatever it's on nowadays, FS1, or I don't think it's on ESPN anymore. But yeah, when they're going and they're spawning, it's just everybody's just posted up on the beds, flipping at them nonstop. You know, it's, I don't know, not my cup of tea.
Yeah, mine either.
I want to engage them. I don't want to shoot the trophy buck off a corn pile.
Right.
You know?
Yes. When you, at some point, you had come and spoke with our members, with Anchored members, and you did this wonderful presentation on bass fishing. And admittedly, I haven't watched it since we did it, but I remember sitting there just with my brain going 100 miles a minute. Can you talk to me about some of the five? Well, let's do, because it's getting late there for you, let's do three key points from your presentation that you think are big takeaways for bass anglers, both new and experienced.
Yeah, if you're doing this on the fly, one of the biggest things is fishing the proper angle. So I think that the way to think about this, and you know, for if you're a trout fisherman or you know just fish for multi-species, a brown trout is a grabber, right? So flies coming, offerings coming, it's going to grab it. A muskie is going to be a grabber. They grab their prey, they hold on to it. A smallmouth is an inhaler, so they suck it in, right? So flies. Downstream angle, roughly, you know, let's just say for it's in its simplest form, let's say a 45 degree angle downstream. And whether you're wading or you're in a boat, fishing that fly as it's coming across, and we fish a lot of flies that are wounded. Like we purposely tied them back. Like you fish the swinging D, that fly is a wounded minnow. So the way that it swims real erratic and kicks all over the place, you can fish that fly on a 45 rod tip down. You're cracking that fly, pausing it, cracking it, pausing it. That fish is going to come up, it's going to T-bone, it's going to turn it, it's going to grab it, it's going to inhale it. You're going to stick that fish, you're going to get a positive hook set. Most likely, more times than not, the fish is going to come across the bow or towards the middle of the river on our rivers. Everything's going to remain tight. You're going to come up, you got the fish on, and now there's no slack ever. Okay? Now, take that same scenario, and you're going to fish off the side of the boat, right? And you're going to be fishing on a 40 or a, you know, 90 off the side. You're stripping. Fish comes and grabs it. You're going to miss a smallmouth a lot of times when they grab that fly coming from that opposite, that different angle. So you may get a reaction out of them. You may get them to eat it. But I would say with clients, 50-50, 60-40, that fish is going to grab it. The angler is going to set the hook and they're going to miss it, or they're going to strip set it and they're going to miss it just by the angle of approach, just changing that angle a little bit. I think that 45, especially on the smaller watershed, it's stealthier, you know, it's a better approach than crossing the fish. You're 45 down, you're just showing them the fly, you know, flying through the air if they see it at all. And then again, the hook set downstream, the fish comes across, everything's tight. We're here. You got, oh, if you get them, you're doing the whole, you know, Johnny Travolta, you know, hook set where you're like, huh. You know, like. You know, we don't put these fish on the reel. It's a if you're stripping them in. So that's the biggest thing. Chapter one, Mike Schultz, Smallmouth 101, 45 degree angle downstream is going to be, you know, more times than not is going to be the answer when you're streamer fishing for them. Lines are very important. I'd say like really tune in your line game. You're going to want to have a line that's a floater. You know, you're going to have, and in my opinion, I like my floating lines to be high 30s, low 40s on the head length. I want to be able to manipulate that fly at distance. So I'll run one line that I'll run for like boogle bugs would be like poppers. I have a line that I run for that that says a little bit longer so I can mend and manipulate at distance. And then I have a line that I run for frog fishing that's a little bit compact, shorter head. That has that you're going to deliver big wind resistant hair flies with. So that's your top water game, couple lines there. And then your subsurface game around here, Airflow now has a line called the Four Season Sniper that works in the winter, in the spring, in the summer, and in the fall. So I can run one line for the whole year. But a lot of anglers will run a full intermediate that is good for cold weather. And then they'll change to a clear tip intermediate that's good for tropical weather, summertime. We're not in the tropics, but if it's 90 degrees in Michigan, you're not going to be fishing an intermediate cold line. It's going to be sticky and burning your fingers and everything else.
Yeah.
So fly line is very important. And then a good fly selection, you know, depending on your, you know, where you're fishing. I think that we're selling this stuff. We're really into it, like clearly. But if you want to be a minimalist, bass are great for it. You really don't need a lot of stuff to do it, you know? So that's kind of cool. So don't really go wild on your fly assortments. And then I give you one more. When you don't run around and kind of chase good fishing, pick a piece of water that's convenient to you, that you live near or your cabin's near or whatever, and intimately learn that piece of water. Don't like kind of chase around. Like, I think that's one thing that people make a mistake of, is like, it's cool to see different water. But when you're in your infancy of fishing for these fish, if you know there's fish in the water, in the river, you know, a good population of fish, focus on a couple beats for your first year and really tune that in. And that'll be very rewarding to you. You know, like just the whole like fly fishing and the way that things have changed with all the information available. And, you know, I don't want to beat that horse, but like, you know, that instant success that everybody seems to want these days. Like, if you want that, pick up a spinning rod. If you want the instant catch fish, fly fishing might not be for you. But one of the greatest things about fly fishing and, you know, spending time on a species and maybe a piece of water, the sense of discovery.
Yeah.
Right. That sense of discovery where like you figured it out. Maybe you came to Schultz Outfitters and we gave you the proper rod, the proper line, proper leader, the proper fly, but you went there and you applied it and you learned something. You know, I think that's one of the coolest things about fly fishing, is just, you're always learning something. You know, whether it's about the fish or the equipment or the way the fly behaves or
yourself.
The way the rod is, yourself. Yeah. I mean, like I love, now that I have the jet boat, I get to fish by myself.
Right.
But, like my wife, you know, Allie gets it. She's like, you're off Monday. All the guides are guiding. Where are you going? Going fishing. The jet boat. It just opens up so much water and you can do things quick. But yeah, I mean, just yeah, I mean, angling with a fly is special. Smallmouth are very special fish, and I think they're very rewarding. You know, they're very accessible to a lot of people, and I think they're a great fish to learn on. Like, we have so many different beats of water, but, you know, like, some have really big fish in them, but low populations. Other ones, you can go catch a bunch of them, and you might get a 18, 19, maybe a 20 inch fish, but like there's so many different games you can play in this area. And that's not just here, that's all around. Just a wonderful fish to learn on, readily available, strong fighting, opportunistic feeders. You know, I read a bunch of books over the years about, you know, trout fishing books that kind of like just take little jabs at smallmouth, like, oh, they're easy. Like, yeah, they're easy when they're this big. They're easy when they're this big. But like, let's see you go out and consistently catch large smallmouth. That's when you really, I think you kind of made it as a smallmouth angler. And when you can go to any section of water and kind of key in on those bigger fish and do things right. You know, it's a special fish. And around here, low pressure.
Yeah.
Low pressure on the rivers. You know, it's special. I've been guiding here since 2003. And three times have I ever been on the water where I ran into another drift boat that wasn't working for me. You know, we wouldn't run into each other if we were working, but you know what I'm saying? Just other people out. And that's even with ultralight rafts that have taken over. You know, everybody's got one of those in their garage these days. You know, unfortunately, a lot of them are conversation pieces because people always forget when you buy one of those things, you still have to learn how to row.
Right.
Chances are your buddy that is coming with you, he wants to go fishing, but he doesn't want to learn how
to
row.
Someone has to row. And I agree with you. I find bass harder than trout, many trout, salmon and steelhead especially, because with salmon and steelhead, you just have to get in front of them and have the conditions be right. But with bass, especially in Australia, they look at, you have to convince them that they want to eat that. And I need to tell you something on that, because Charles bought a bunch of flies from your shop when he was there. I do not know what they're called. I included them in a vlog post that I did on my YouTube channel titled Why I Think You Should Fly Fish for Bass. That fly has changed everything for us. It's got a weird shape of foam.
Oh, yeah, like a swinging D, the foam head.
Is that what it is? Is it the swinging D?
Is it a streamer?
Yeah, but we fish, but it fishes on the top of the water.
Not sure which one that was.
I will find out what it is, and I will actually, maybe I should post about it, because it really did change our fishing. It has absolutely nailed fish for us. And so I wanted to ask you two last questions just on the fishing side of things, and then we will start to wrap it up. But you mentioned earlier making modifications to flies or tying flies specifically that are not, as you said, you know, in from the box. What do you, what do you mean?
Yeah. So, one thing is, so when I first started doing this, we fished a lot of lead flies, right? So flies with dumbbell eyes, right? And this is, you know, we're dating ourselves again, but like there was no swim flies. There was no game changer. There was no swing and D. There was no, you know, it was like you had, flies that went like this and you had flies that went like this. Yeah. You know, that's what you had. And then you had obviously your topwater flies. You know, maybe, you know, if it was 1990, that was 2005 and I was out bass fishing, early season, I would be throwing like a little leech, black, simple leech with red eyes, maybe some flash on it or a little sculpin pattern or whatever. But if you remember, we fish a lot of intermediate lines. So I need to make a fly maybe that's this big for that early season stuff that has three different dumbbell sizes on it, right? That's just in its simplest form. That would be a modification that I would say. You got 3.5-inch fly. You got it with a medium dumbbell eye. You got it with a large dumbbell eye. And then you've got it with a large dumbbell eye with a little tungsten bead hidden in the head. So you got three different weights. And you're going to fish that different, not necessarily for the depth of the water, but the speed of the water. So like one of these rivers that we got, let's just take the Huron, for example. Right now, if you pulled up the USGS, you know, graph of how much water is coming down it, we refer to it as cubic feet per second in the United States. There might be 500 cubic feet per second of water coming down right now. Springtime, when we have snow melt and big rains and whatnot, that same river could be running at 2,500 CFM. Summertime, it could be running at 100. So you're going to need different flies for all that. So in its simplest form, different weights for those flies that jig. We call them dredgers. Your lead flies could be a single hook fly like a red-eyed leech, could be a S3 sculpin, it could be a crayfish or a circus peanut. Russ Madden's creation, he's a Michigan boy. You know, circus peanut was a game changer for a lot of different people before the game changer. Right. You know, it was Russ used to work for Kelly. Russ made the platform of the two hooks together back in, you know, 1876. I don't know what year it was, but you know, and Kelly had it and he ran with it with all these different crazy creations. But that style fly that just swam like that, that's an important piece of our program. Now you get into swim flies. Or you say, let's just say like a simple swim fly that most people would know would be like a feather game changer. You know, it could be that long. It could be that long, however you want to tie it. But you could tie that same feather game changer with just feathers for the head. Or you could tie that same fly with like a brush head. Like one of my favorites is the EP Crustaceous brush. It's kind of real airy. And you could put that on there and that fly is going to have suspending properties. Versus one that just has a feather head might drop quicker. You could take that a step further and you could take that feather changer and put a tungsten bead under the crustaceous brush. And now you got a little bit heavier and you're on the water and you want to get a little bit deeper. You could take 0.025 or 0.030 lead, wrap it around the front hook and put a keel on it. You know, so all these little modifications that you can do depending on how you want it to swim, how deep you want it to swim. Do you want it to swim perfect like a little bait fish or do you want it to swim like it's messed up?
I was going to ask, how do you make them look injured? Is that all with weight?
With weight or with different shape heads. So like the swing and D has a foam head and the swing and D, it stands for swinging Dahlberg. So Dahlberg, Larry Dahlberg, he created that style head, the diver head. So I simply took that diver head that you could buy from at the time, or still now to this day, Rainey's made the diver head. And I made that articulated fly that you have to fish it on a 45 because if you fish it off the side of the boat, it's going to go straight. But if you fish it with that, you know, the current pushing on it, now you can make that thing do all kinds of wild stuff. So the head shape coupled with the, how much lead you put on it gets you a different depth. Too much lead is going to deaden it. It's not going to swim good. Not enough. It's going to float on the surface. You're kind of playing that game. And, you know, depending on who tied it and, you know, what feathers you use and what under materials you use, it's going to swim different, you know? So it's all a big game. And then here to add more confusion to it, like, what's it going to do if you run a 4-foot leader versus a 9-foot leader?
What is it going to do?
It depends on how you tie the fly. So if it's really short leash, it's not going to have as much, you know, room to kind of do its thing. It's, you know, where it's not like, you know, just like to break it down in its simplest form, let's tie the knot directly to the fly or let's tie a loop in it.
What do you do?
For streamers, I'm going to tie a loop.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but if I'm fishing bigger water, I'm going to use a longer leader sometimes. Or if I'm fishing smaller water, I might use a little bit shorter leader. And then if you're bass fishing, you need to build your own leaders, you know? So I'm going to take like that intermediate line that I might have on a 7-weight or an 8-weight. I'm going to take 40-pound line. I'm going to tie that to 30. I'm going to tie that to 25. I'm going to tie that to 20. And I might tie it to 16 on a line that I'm going to chuck into the Menominee River or the Manistee River or the Muskegon River or the Mississippi, all M's. That's kind of weird. But you know, where I'm tracking the fly distance, where I'm around here, I might go 30, 20, 16, and I'm like, leader only might be that long, you know, depending on conditions.
So why are you making your own specifically? Why not? And maybe this goes back to things that the industry needs to be improving. Mm-hmm. Why can't you just pick up one off the shelf?
Yeah, most of the ones, I mean, you grab any leader off the shelf right now, it's going to probably have like a 25-pound butt section, maybe a 30, and go down to whatever, you know, it says, you know,
and on the end. You want 40 specifically to be able to turn the flies over or to for presentation, for how it's fishing?
Yeah, I mean, I think like depending on the weight of the line and then also how thick the line is. So every line is going to be different, but you want that to come off that line and be the same,
smooth,
you know,
yeah,
taper down. Where a lot of these leaders, you grab them and you're like, I mean, I don't even carry any saltwater, you know, leaders that say permit on them or anything. Like, how am I going to send you permit fishing with a leader off the wall? Are you kidding me? The guy's going to be like, snip, see ya,
yeah,
you know, like immediately. So, yeah, I mean, like you really fly, you get what you put in, you know, really when it comes down to anything in life, but fly fishing and leader performance, I mean, you got to tie your own. You really
right,
do.
I guess, especially nowadays with the really thick, concentrated, dense fly lines.
And the loop.
Smooth, yeah. For the smooth energy transition, it's not going to work going into, I mean, it will work, but how smooth
not
it's
the way, not the way that you want it to work. Maybe
Hinge
the way
City.
That the guy, that, yeah, the angler that just started, like, this is good enough, you know, but like, as you get into it, you fine tune everything, you know? So yeah, I build my own leaders. I'm not sponsored by them or anything, but I am a Hatch leader material junkie. Like that, the stuff is out of this world. Like, it's
what's
so
Hatch?
Good.
Oh my gosh.
I'm still
Hatch is making leaders.
Yeah. I think they make leaders, but I use their mono and their fluorocarbon. They've been making it for years.
Yeah.
But yeah. Back when Andrew Dickinson was working for him,
he's not there anymore.
No, he's been gone for since before since COVID.
Oh my God. I've got to get an update on what's going on out there.
You got to build your own leaders, kids.
Yeah, no, I love it. And actually that the last couple trips I've been on, I'm not sponsored by a rod company anymore either. And so I've just been using whatever rods are available. And the last two trips I've been like, why does this feel like shit? And it was because the leader was definitely not right for the rod. And so we switched it up and everything was fine after that. Knowing that the fish inhales rather than say bites as such, like we would expect, grabs. How does that change your retrieve?
Well, smallmouth, you know, that was another one that I probably missed there when you say, give me my top three or, you know, give me your top three. Pause, right? Smallmouth are suckers for a fly that pauses, right?
Oh,
so
yeah,
you'll see them kind of like, if you get in the perfect conditions, then, you know, sometimes they give you this view where, you know, you see the fish come up on it and they're not just going to, if they're not really in that mood just to swim right through it, they're going to come up and you're going to pause that fly. They're going to come up right behind it. Maybe you twitch it and then they eat it. You know, they really like the paused fly, something that looks wounded. So a smallmouth, you know, it's not like you really can't be robotical, you know, in your retrieves. It's not just chuck it out, strip, 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 chuck it out, strip, strip. They're not that kind of fish. They want to have that fly kind of somewhat finesse to them most of the time. And pausing that fly and letting it hang, especially early season. So when the water's cold, they're not chasing, and you know, they want that fly just to suspend and hang on their face. So flies like the swinging D or modified versions of a game changer where you have different weights and you're kind of getting that fly to suspend, or you're getting that fly to have a slow fall by the shape you're cutting the head, all very important parts, you know, but you know, keys, like, you know, just like a tip, like, don't overcomplicate it when you first start, you know, like, get some data in here, you know, that you witnessed and you see, because like, you can go down a rabbit hole on the internet and everybody's an expert these days and everybody knows everything. But, you know, I always tell clients when they come in here, it's like, get with somebody that you trust and you respect and kind of follow that path. Like, you're going to just, your head's going to explode if you go down that path of, you know, madness online these days. But keep it simple when you're starting, you know, learn how to fit. It's like over here, like, you may not know this, but behind this wall is a conventional tackle shop. So I have all the crazy, you know, like Mega Bass and Depths and all these like wild Japanese companies and whatnot over there. And like, you look at the wall and you see like categories of baits, jerk baits, let's just say that. There's every brand and swims just slightly different, you know? And all we're doing with these flies nowadays, with these swim flies, is you're replicating what's going on over there.
So you're selling convention. You must have changed the shop. There were the two rooms before. So now when you walk in to the white part, not the one with all the, with the window, when you walk in initially, well, your fly time materials were.
Oh, it's gone. Everything's gone. So you walk in, you still got the fly room, you got the rods, you got the flies, you got the fly lines and leader and tippet. Second room's like pretty much all Sims. We got Squala as well. Third room where I'm sitting right now, this was the fly tying room. There was a wall right here. Now this whole room behind me is all fly tying.
Oh my God. It looks great.
Yeah. Yep. And then behind this wall going into the fourth room, that's all conventional tackle. So like, there's probably easily $250,000 worth of conventional tackle over there with rods and reels and all that stuff. So
which one do you make the most sales off of, fly or conventional?
Still fly.
Okay.
Yeah. Still. Yeah. It's, you know, our core of our client base is fly, but I just, honestly, April, I got sick of people coming in here every day and going, where's the real fishing stuff?
Right. Okay.
Where's the rods and reels? Like, well, maybe one day.
Right.
Yeah. They're here now. So yeah, I couldn't turn all these customers away, and they're good people. And, you know, I've learned that, like, from a business standpoint, what a different consumer.
Really? How so?
Like, totally different. I mean, just our fly people are so loyal. Like, it's like they would, if our rods were 100, like some of these people, if it was $100, they buy it online for $800 and we're selling for $9, they're still going to buy it from us, you know, just because they realize the value of, you know, what myself and the staff provide. We're over here. There's a lot of online sales, you know, or they're tackle warehouse junkies or they're Omnia or whatever, and they'll come here. But, you know, the biggest compliment I get here is like, I can actually touch it, feel it, see it. Like, it's in my hands. I don't have to click and buy it, you know, and we have stuff here that nobody else in the state has, you know, a lot of really wild, oddball stuff that, you know, like, you're not going to know a lot of these companies unless you're hardcore and you're really into it,
right?
You know? So, just different consumer, you know, like our events and the culture that we built, the community that we built here on the fly end of things. Like, I quickly learned when I opened this, like, don't try to mingle them. Don't try to like do conventional stuff with your fly stuff that you've already have proven to be this thing. Like, they want nothing to do with fly people, but you have so much crossover. You have so many fly people that you didn't know that were, you know, like, they're anglers. Like, you know, I mean, Larry Dahlberg says it the best. Like, if you're just a fly angler, you're just peeping through the keyhole. You don't know anything.
So true. Charles is a major gearhead. You should see our tackle room. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be. I mean, if you really want to be a complete angler, I'm not just, I mean, I really, my love for, I've always loved angling and I always loved fishing, but my passion for like fishing with bait casters and spinning reels and doing that kind of stuff really was restoked by my kids. Like, how am I going to teach a 4-year-old how to fly fish the way I like to fly fish? It's
right.
Tanner's not going to be out there at age 5 stripping a 6-inch game changer on an intermediate line. So I started that Evelyn, on in the conventional stuff again, just to spend time with your kids. And
yeah,
you
know, they totally love
it. They're stiff.
And it's great to tag team. I mean, Charles Fish is a little, for our bass, Charles Fish is a little Sammy. Mm-hmm. And I fish your fly, which now is driving me insane. I'm definitely going to have to pull this up. And we tag team and we learn from each other that way. I think that mm-hmm. if you don't fish conventional or if you haven't fished conventional, you're doing yourself a major disservice. So kudos to you. I love it. Watching your career has been very fun. I've watched you go from, I mean, obviously we met when you were already in the fishing industry, but watching you have the shop and then, you know, I think I saw you come on to be a Loomis ambassador. And then I know you work with Yeti and you've kind of just, you've come a long way, kid, you know, it's been awesome, but it's just starting. You're in your prime. So what's next?
Oh yeah. I mean, I just honestly, like right now, just sustaining what we've got going on, keeping my crew all intact. We got amazing staff. Things that we've really bumped up over the last couple of years has been, you know, our push of just higher quality media. So I've got a guy named Nick now that handles all that. It's not me like on my phone trying to make all that happen and playing, you know, wearing a million different hats. Eventually we will come up, we'll have an online store. It's already, you know, half built and that'll go down. I'm kind of really April, to be honest with you. Right now I'm in that phase where I'm just trying to be the best dad that I can be in this crazy yes. world that our kids are in right now. So I spend a lot of time at the rink, a lot of time at the baseball diamond, with the boys. And then I obviously still get a lot of fishing in. I still guide for 3.5 months, like an animal, 5 days a week, with my top clients. I mean, I've got it to the point now where I'm taking people fishing that I love and I care about that are big parts of my life and, are serious about fishing. I'm a coach, you know, on the water and, I got my guiding down to about 98% single angler. So I get to go one-on-one and I can fish ways that I really enjoy and fish different angles. And I got it going pretty good right now. And I like where we're at as a staff. I think eventually, you know, we're going to outgrow the shop. We're going to have to make a move. And, that's kind of in the sights. It's just, how much time you got, you know, do I have 36 hours in the day and 450 days in the year? I don't. I'm still working with the same timeline you're working on and everybody else's. So yeah, time is very, very important. And family has been taking the forefront the last couple of years with the kids growing up and trying to keep them on the right path.
Well, you're a good man. And I really mean that. And I don't say that in every episode, but you're a really good man with great integrity. And so I hope that people do come by and explore the shop, whether you're there or not, because you've got Greg Senyo there. You've got some serious talent over there.
Oh yeah. No, Greg's our operation manager. He's doing a bunch of cool stuff right now. He's got a kind of revamping his fly materials and he has a bunch of stuff that just hit the market from Montana Fly. Greg's got the fire re-stoked after the crazy COVID years and whatnot. And so look out for Senyo. You know, he's coming back winging. He's got a bunch of cool stuff coming out. I'm blessed to spend, you know, 4 or 5 days a week with him by my side, helping me navigate this crazy business.
Love it. Just a shameless plug. Where can people find you moving forward?
Yeah. I mean, we're really active on social media. So, Schultz Outfitters on Instagram, Schultz Outfitters on Facebook, www.schultzoutfitters.com. If you Instagram message, there's a really good chance that I'm going to be the one answering. So, I don't give that up. I believe strongly that the person that has the name on the building should be handling a lot of that stuff. So if you have any crazy questions or anything, good chance I'll be answering it. Anytime between 7 a.m. and 11, I'm on there hustling. And outside of that, I'm sleeping, trying to sleep. And that's about it. So check us out on social medias. That Nick's got a little YouTube channel going for us now. So if you want to learn how to tie some of the crazy flies that we've helped develop and use during our programs, you're not going to find those anywhere else, you know, especially the ones that are tied by us. Obviously, people are out there ripping it off and doing their own thing with it. But if you want the originals and how we do it, find us on YouTube, Schultz Outfitters. And that's about it. We're pretty easy, pretty accessible. We're not too fancy for the common man or woman. So hit us up. Yeah, give us a call, email, Instagram message. We got you.
Perfect. Anything that you'd like to add before we wrap it up and you go home to your family?
No, just thank you for your time, Ape. I really appreciate it. And
thank you.
Yeah. give us a shout at Schultz Outfitters. We'll get you hooked up.
I'll see you late October, early November, and I'm dead serious about that. So I'll follow up.
Rock and roll.
All right. Thanks, Schultz. Talk to you soon. Bye. And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.